Today's guest on In the Arena is Nick Maxwell, who would be well known to a lot of people in certainly my world as the captain of Collingwood's 2010 Premiership team. But he comes with a big story, and the big story of his early days is actually not making it, of setback after setback, opportunity after opportunity, which he was never able to fulfil. He got, I think it was four AFL clubs who knocked him back before he actually got a chance of being on a rookie list of the Collingwood Football Club. And then some 10 years later, he's actually captaining Collingwood to that premiership. And he's then actually taken the learnings from it. And I think all of the lessons that he's learned, he's obviously a bright guy, but he's super curious. The lessons he's learned, he's now then taken into other places, initially as a leadership coach with Melbourne Storm, and initially then with GWS, and then back to Collingwood. And now formed a business which I've basically, even my own alliance with, if you like, I'm big on, you know, creating alliances for yourself, is a business called Eclair in East Hawthorne, which is just a magnificent, certainly a beautiful place to work from. But most importantly, what they've done is they've created a culture here which you just get totally attracted to and find that and feel that you can get the best from yourself and whatever your endeavours are. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I often talk of culture as an outcome, and the outcome that he has been able to produce as both a premiership captain but now as a very successful person in business is that this particular episode of In the Arena is just full of wisdom. And I also again get the sense that the best of Nick Maxwell is still to come. Enjoy. Okay, I'm here with Nick Maxwell, CEO of Eclair. CEO of Eclair, how does that sound for you? Just that idea of being a CEO of something.
I don't really think about it like that, to be honest. I think it's more what influence can I have on the team that I'm working with.
Yeah.
And more than anything, I'm a big promoter of those who I work with. So every time we walk in a parlour and I'm introducing someone, I say, here's Thais. She runs parlour down here. She's in charge of all this, and sort of help show her that that's the responsibility that she's got, and then go through to upstairs, and I go, here's Alex, she runs all our bureau, she's in charge of that. And I keep working through everyone and go, here's Loz, she really runs the show, I've got the title, but she's the one who's here every day doing all that. And go into Jesse and go, he's the one who helped find all this and create all this, and he's the one that was the driving force behind it. He's got IT and branding experience, and I'm sort of more the front of house person, so we complement each other well. And here's Paul, who believed in the vision that we had and what he did to be able to help bring this together for us. So it's more about trying to show the support to all the people. And if I keep going through them all, that'll be a whole podcast. But
yeah.
So I feel bad that I've left some of them out. But I think for me, it's around just how can I help each of them in their roles and help them feel supported and help them challenge them at different stages for the expectations that we have as a business. Mm. Understanding that the buck does end up stopping with the CEO, and that that pressure and the things that we need to do is part of it. But when you've been captain of Collingwood and you've had to play in front of 100,000 people, that pressure is sort of something that isn't as scary as what it can be, I guess.
Yeah, and in some ways, I was thinking almost in the context of identity as well.
Yep.
You know, for you, because there's a probably since you could remember, really, the game was your identity.
Yep.
And then it became, the club became part of that, then captain of the club, then captain of a premiership team, then became that. And you then extended that into your life beyond the game in those ways. And I've got to say, I've been quite amazed with what seems like from the outside looking in quite a seamless transition for you. And the experience of all of those things plays out in my experience of being here.
Yep.
And particularly in regard to the people around the place, I would say that more than anything, that universally people say, geez, some great people there.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Oh, well, that's, I think you can't have any successful business without good people behind it. So finding them is obviously difficult, but once you find them, you just don't want to let them go. And I think that's a big part of it. So certainly identity, I'm probably different in that I tried out and was not wanted by Port Adelaide and Hawthorne, then Geelong, across a couple of year period, and then was a rookie at Collingwood, and then got another 1 year deal as a rookie again. So I was sort of, my identity was never
fully a footballer. In the game.
Yeah, it was always knew that it could be taken away tomorrow. So I probably didn't identify like that. I was me who was doing other things outside of football, knowing it could end any time. And then football was obviously the passion and what I wanted to do. But I also had my best mates in the world are still my mates that I went to school with. How long, 20 years ago, whatever that is now. So more than 20 years. So those guys kept me grounded and they all are my greatest support and also the first ones to tear me down when I made a mistake, which is part of that brotherhood that we have. So, and obviously your family, that they're there no matter what and they ride every bump with you. So I think for me, the identity piece is certainly a massive issue in our game, in all athletes, because a lot of the time, more often than not, the best player in the team growing up is the one that ends up being the one that does get drafted. So they've been told since they were 15, because they've made every interleague squad and every representative squad, that you're going to make it, you're the next AFL player. And that's thousands and thousands of people are told that, but yet only sort of, 50 or 60 get drafted every year from the whole country, not from just that one league and that one team. So I think that identity is a massive issue, and that's something as a past players group we're really working on to try and support players while they're in the game. That's your Cameron Schwader who plays football, and yes, that has to be your priority, but it's not everything about who you are and what you are, so that when it is taken away, which it inevitably will be it through injury, be it through you're just not good enough, or be it through your own decision if you're lucky enough in that 0.01% that get to make that decision.
Yeah, very few get to make their own call.
Yeah, so it's going to happen though. So it's what's after that. There's a lot more living to do, and be it, I've seen players that have come through that have been on seven figures and have come out of the game and they're just, a shell of themselves because they've got nothing else because they've lost that identity. So it's about how can we best set them up to succeed post sport, post being an athlete.
Yeah, and I must admit I've changed my view a little bit on that, that the game can only do so much, if you like, and how we help people form an alliance, a group of alliance. It's interesting because I've spoken to Lauren Burns recently about this, that, and she's done a PhD on this, is the importance of alliances, you know, in your life. And I can't remember exactly the term she used, it's like a performance alliance, if you like. And you need to have that in the game, as in people who believe in you. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the coach. It just has to be someone, you know, at that time. But to have something outside of the sport is part of it. And we do ask a lot of, you know, the athletes who play in it. And the people, and it sounds like you had a version of that just because it took you longer to get into the system than perhaps you would have ideally have liked. Yep. But in the end, those setbacks may well have served you well in regard to forming who you actually are.
100%. Like post-career, it's 100% it has. And that was, like, Tarkin Lockyer and I started a business out of what was then the Lexus Centre, where we'd get there at 4:35 o'clock in the morning and run personal training groups. And then after hours, we'd do big footy groups and take them through basically a three-hour AFL pre-season with all the different elements of it. So that taught us about business, taught us about work ethic, about there's other things out there. Working in commentary with Channel 7 and SEN. And then by the time I finished, I sort of had a lot of different things going on. So I was a BDM role where I was meeting different people in different marketing groups and different businesses. So learning a lot with Rob Hilton doing that. Then I went to the Storm to see a whole new sport with Frank Panisi and Craig Bellamy. And then when the Giants asked me with Leon Cameron to start doing their leadership stuff, that was, I guess, another moment where I went, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this. I ended up, I did 226 flights in 18 months because I was still based in Melbourne.
Based here, were you?
Yeah. Wow. But I didn't want to get to the end of that and say, right, I've read some books or I've watched some movies, because I knew there'd be a lot of lonely time there as well on planes and in airports and hotel rooms. So I did my MBA in that 18 months. So again, it was, how can I do things that are going to help me be better, basically, and improve me? Because that's sort of what we're all about, really, isn't it? That's what life's about, is trying to find other experiences and other ways to improve ourselves and improve those around us.
It clearly is for you. where does that come from for you, do you think? Where did that drive come from? Do you ever, I always say to my kids, if it's nature or nurture, it's both my fault. Is what there is an element of, you know, because people will often talk to my curiosity a little bit, and I go, well, I don't think I ever have made a choice on that. I think it was just part of. I can even being as a kid being like that. It was just always being. There's always another book to read, another podcast to listen to, another conversation to be had.
Yep. Well, I think the first one's probably like my old man had his own business and would leave before we'd wake up and go and work all day, get back at the end of the day and pitch black outside, and we'd be under the street lights to kick the footy out in the middle of the road and run out when the cars would come past. So he'd always find time, and he'd coach us on weekends and stuff. So he was always there. But being when I was growing up as a teenager, being able to go into work and actually in school holidays and earn a few extra dollars and see how he treated his staff and how much they respected and appreciated the way he went about it. So it's hard to run a business, and he had at different stages up to sort of 80 to 100 people under him. My mum, as a I don't want to say what age she was, but I was certainly at least in my sort of 20s when she did this. She went across to Africa and spent a few weeks over there in the slums with St. Joseph's College and some of the other people from there to help them build an orphanage that they were trying to build over in Africa. So I mean, taking yourself out of your comfort zone and trying to do things like that is just incredible for someone who didn't have to but just wanted to make a difference. So I think you're always – that's probably the combination of taking those things on. But then a lot of it is just unknown. I remember when someone interviewed them, a reporter about once we had – about me, and they asked about, well, when he got cut from the Falcons 4 years in a row and then when he got overlooked by all these clubs, like – what happened? Like, what did you say to him? What did you do? And I remember them saying, because they wear every single bruise and bump. So as parents, you just, every parent does. You're like, you just want to help, and like, you just want them, everyone to be happy and healthy and all that, and to live their dreams. And they said that, we don't know. He just grit his teeth and go, I'll show them type thing. So, but again, if dad hadn't run a business that was really successful and managed all that and done all that, and if mum hadn't gone to do the things that she did, and like you go to mum about, all right, we've got a fundraiser coming up. She goes, what can I do? What do you need to do? Like, she's just
got that energy,
that empathy, and what can I do for anyone? Yeah. So, I don't know the answer, but I know that I couldn't have been any luckier with the people that I had to guide me through that journey.
Yeah, which is it's very aligned to Lauren's findings in terms of the successful athletes and what's and the importance of actually forging it and finding it. So it seems that you had that good mix of in the game and outside the game. You're obviously in a great club and, you know, really well coached. You had a situation and circumstance. And so even as a take, and I was thinking, even as it related to this conversation, was the thing I've never really spoken to you about was the sense that when you found your way into the game and it took more setbacks than most, and it seems like those setbacks did serve you well in that way. They might not have felt like that probably at the time. But then when you actually found yourself in the game and then leadership started finding its way to you, that you became a better player when you became captain of Collingwood. Is it just an observation, or is it this that I was taking more notice of you at that time, do you think?
Well, the statistics say that I did. I was better in everything that I did from 2009 onwards. So and all your best and fairest and all Australian and all those type of things came post being named captain. I think early on, I didn't know what leadership was. I'd never been taught leadership. I've captained one team in my life. Again, I wasn't one of the better players. I was never seen as someone who was in that position.
Is that right? So you weren't captain of any of the junior sides or anything like that?
No. So by the time we got to... So James Clement and Nathan Buckley sat me down when I'd played about 20 games and said, we want you to nominate for the leadership group. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, embarrassed. Like, I'm barely in the team. I could be cut any week. And they told me what leadership was. They said, leadership is that you're a hero in the morning trying to get yourself better. You train as hard as anyone. If you get injured, you do everything you possibly can to get back quicker than whatever number they're giving you on weeks you're going to miss. You're always organising like dinners and stuff with players that come in. You check in with everyone all the time. And they gave me all these different things about what leadership was. And for me, I had no idea.
You just hadn't defined it that way.
No. So they sort of said, so you're a leader and you're someone who people follow because you do all these things. So all of a sudden I was like, okay, well, if that's leadership and two people that I had huge respect for, so I'm like, okay, well, I want to take on board what they think and their observations and their experiences. So they were the ones that drove me into going into that position. And I guess from there, you just keep learning and keep trying to improve. And I was probably – the leadership stuff came naturally to me. So that's why I didn't know any different.
Yeah, whereas, so that stuff of getting people organised in the morning, looking after your own development, taking – it seems there's two elements to it. One, you're taking responsibility for your own career. That's the first thing that I hear when you speak to that. And secondly, there's a something innate where you want to take other people with you as part of that. That you're so they're by any definition leadership, but you're just trying to find your way in footy.
Yeah, and also like even from the first time I actually had my own house, I was as soon as I could. It was all right. Which players need somewhere to live? So Sean Rusling was moving across from South Australia, so he moved in, and then. Heritier was moving across from WA, so he moved in. So I had them, and then after 2 years, Heritier went to get his own place, and Sherrod Wellingham moved in, so I had him and I had Sean. So again, it was more how can I help them, how can I support them, and be a part of their journey almost, but just to give them the best opportunity, because moving into state, I only moved from Geelong to Melbourne, so I could always whip home if I wanted to, but for them it's a lot harder. So, and I've still got always great relationships now. I was just over in South Australia for Gather Round early in the year and caught up with Sean. So again, it's just I didn't know what it was, leadership, and that sort of helped me. But I guess from a playing perspective, it changed in 2008. We had a final series over in Adelaide, and Scott Thompson was basically the hot on baller. He was for many years, but that year in particular. And
40 times a game.
Oh, dominant, yeah. And I was asked to tag him in the midfield, which I'd never played in the midfield before.
You don't strike me as a midfielder.
Since I was about 11. I ended up sort of cutting him out of the game and kicking a couple of goals, and we won over at Footy Park when we were the underdogs. And I guess the plaudits you get for playing a role that helps win a final, it feels good. And I was like, oh, this feels good. I want more of this. I need to be a better player. So I remember we lost the next week to the Saints, I think it was. But I remember going in with Jeff Walsh and Mick Malthouse, and through the preseason, they were talking about, well, we've got a captain to pick now because Scotty Burns had just retired. And you're in the leadership group. There's about five of us that had been in the leadership group the year before. And they said, why should you be a leader? And again, I sort of went through the things that I do off the field, but I said, I don't think you've got any concerns about the off the field or the fact that I can talk in front of the media and all that type of thing. I think the only concern you'd have is me as a player. And all I can say is that gave me a taste for how I need to be a better player and I want to be a better player. And that's what you're going to see through the whole preseason is me trying to become a better player. Because I'd always just been like, just play your role, just do all the little things and just stay out of the way, basically. But I was like, I want to take on more of that. And fortunate enough, I continued to improve through pre-season. And then that first year of 2009, first year as captain, was an All-Australian because I had improved and probably only some injury. I actually felt I played better in 2010, but I missed about a 4 or 5 week block with a calf in the middle of the year. So, and then 2011 was a bit of a write-off because I had some pretty serious injuries. And
early, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, but it's about, again, the standard that you find yourself on, but then you can't go back from that standard. And that's, I was just talking to my 11-year-old who just had the game of his life last week where he played the best game he's ever played. And I just said, that's the expectation now, that's how you're going to play every week. Because otherwise you just became someone that can just pull out a good game every now and then. So actually talking them through, so what were the things you did to play well, like, and how do you feel about it? And so you talk about, well, I feel really good about it. I feel like everyone was saying how well I played and all that type of thing. I said, yeah, but how do you feel? He goes, well, I feel good because I was getting a lot of the ball and we won the game and all that. So again, just trying to break it down for him to sort of show that, well, you've set an expectation for yourself now that's how you're going to do. So you need to train hard. You need to do all that. It doesn't just happen. You can't just show up and expect it's going to happen again next week. So, which is hard because it's an 11-year-old. So you're trying to work with them on a lot of different things in their life. But at the same time, he loves his footy.
Does he?
Yeah.
And he's up for the conversation.
Correct.
So I'm thinking about the time when you find yourself in the midfield, because you wouldn't have spent a lot more time in the midfield at any stage in your career. Was it something that you initiated or something that was asked of you?
No, it would have been asked of me at that stage. Yeah, I definitely I didn't have the front to go and make a call like that to the coach. But I remember I'd broken my wrist, I think it was the week before against Sydney, about 5 minutes to go in the game. So I used to have great battles with Ryan O'Keefe, who was superstar centre forward who, for the Swans.
Could run and run.
Oh, just couldn't stop running. And that was why he got people, but just seemed to have some good games against him. So we played against them, and really late in the game, I put on a spoil and my wrist just got on a bad angle and broke. And then we're going into a final series, and I'm like, I'm not missing this. So strap it up, put some, sort of this harder sort of plastic across the top of it. Yeah. And I was just like, I'm playing no matter what I have to do. So if it kills me, I'm going to be playing. So
you're playing in the midfield with a broken wrist when you've never played in the midfield before. So there's a bit going on here.
Yeah.
And the thought I'm having is that someone, both as a leader and the stories you told about Buckley and Clement, and even in the role you're now playing in the side, is someone seeing something in you that perhaps you hadn't seen in yourself?
100%, point. And that's also from even going back to, I remember sitting down with Mick. I played for Williamstown my whole first year, and it was because Williamstown was Collingwood's alliance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd only trained once with the senior team for the whole season. And it was because Mick would go, nah, the bottom 10 on the list, like, they can go down to Williamstown because they'll just stuff training up on what we're trying to do. So
Alan Jeans used to call it Brumby Corner. You don't want these guys messing up training. Go and train in Brumby Corner at Glenferrie Oval.
And it was, this is 2003, so they've just come off almost winning the premiership and then going to the grand final again. So it was obviously a bloody good team. So
So we don't want Nick Maxwell messing up training.
Correct, And lucky enough, a lot of those alliances don't work because the Collingwood players go back to Williamstown, and then the Williamstown players are threatened and they're going to push Williamstown players out. But Brad Gotch was down there as coach, and we're lucky enough we had Brad Lloyd and Troy West as captains. And a range of other guys who were just unbelievable in guys like Sammy Cranage and Marcus Baldwin.
It'd all been in the AFL system. Correct. Yeah.
And they just, they helped, like, they wrap your arms around you. And like Westy taught me so much because I played obviously down with him in the back line and just learned so much from them. So that alliance, we won the premiership in the VFL. And then, the senior boys played in the grand final and lost to Brisbane, but it was obviously successful programs in the way we went about it. So, but again, it's about those people around you and what you're learning from them. And again, I don't think a lot of the time you're really spending too much. Now the conversations actually happen, but back then you're not really thinking too deeply about it, which it sort of becomes ingrained in you. And it was interesting. When I went to the Melbourne Storm, I said to Cooper Cronk, I said, mate, there's no values on the walls or anything like that. And he said, nah. He goes, here, you've got to take it in. You've got to feel it. You've got to earn the right to know what it is we're all about. And I was like, okay, that's good. I remember starting a conversation with him about, well, I said, well, when you're gone and Smithy's gone and Bill's gone and Hinchy and those boys, how are they all going to know, how are you going to know in 20 years that it's been carried on? So we actually did come up with like just a phrase that still sits on the wall about what a Melbourne Storm player is, so that at least there is something on there that you can go back to. But then also the way they continually add to that legacy is bring the past players back and just bring the past players back every single week. Every time they travel interstate, someone at dinner, and it might not be a big speech or anything like that. It might just be they're sitting at dinner and having a conversation with a young boy. So, and I think that's been a big factor in why they've been so successful.
And not having to articulate it in, because sometimes our capacity to articulate what we're feeling almost does it injustice in lots of ways.
Yep.
And that's why some of the great, culture statements of all time almost feel irrelevant, like, sweep the sheds, the famous All Blacks. Well, you couldn't invent that. You couldn't create that. But it's probably the most endorsed form, values, because there's all forms of humility in it. Yep. No one looks after the All Blacks, the All Blacks look after themselves, that sort of mindset.
Yep.
And often, if we're not careful, when they call it weasel words, we go to these sort of words which are, and I have a line when people, because I do a little bit of value stuff with organisation now, I said, if it's too obvious, it can't be trusted, is the term, if it's too obvious. And so often I go, Pete Carroll at ex-Seattle Seahawks, only recently ex-Seattle Seahawks, he would just ask the team, if it was really good, what would it be like?
Yep.
What would it be like? And that's a nice way of doing it as well.
I think as much as you can put historic stories into it as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So Sweet the Sheds, there's obviously a story behind that where they had all their families and partners and like coming into the rooms afterwards and they had tape and dirt and all that other place. Yeah. So we can't bring them in here now.
Almost out of shame.
Correct, yeah. So that was sort of a little part of that story, as well as obviously leave the place in a better space than where it was before.
Yeah.
Look after what we can control. All those little things, attention to detail. But it was also, it started out as, geez, we can't bring them in here.
No, it's just practical. Yeah. We can't go to the local pub to have our, there's no corporate events. We do want to have a version of an aftermatch. Yep. And you're inviting your mum and your kids into the rooms. Correct. It just had that. And then it became this beautiful, if you just put a sign on the wall, the All Blacks are humble, or humility, it doesn't say nearly as much as we sweep the sheds.
No,
we sweep
the 100%. Sheds. And that's where, even from a, don't want to jump too far forward, but from an eClub perspective, it's people come in here and they go, who've experienced it, and you'll be able to talk to this or tell me I'm full of shit. It's an amazing fit. I've never seen anything like it.
No,
your technology is phenomenal. It's amazing. But it's actually the people that make it so welcoming. They just look after you. They've always got a smile on the face. No matter how you're feeling, the E-Class staff bring you up.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of emotional connection that goes away from a transaction where you're not coming to hire office space or to hire a meeting room or have an event or whatever it is. It's actually you're buying into something bigger than that. And it's hard from a selling perspective to talk to that, because it's people taking a massive leap of faith in what you're telling them about how they'll feel in a month or 3 months or 6 months from being here. So it's because you can see fit out, you can see technology, but you can't see that sort of underlying thing of how you feel when you're actually here, which is, again, the only thing I can give it credit to is the staff that go out of their way to make sure every single moment is a good moment for the member. And that's, we'll make mistakes, things won't work, all that type of thing. But as long as you've got the attention of the staff, the members got the attention, they know you're doing everything in your power to fix whatever that issue might be.
Yeah, and it is, it's not a coincidence, obviously. There is an enormous amount of work goes into that. And even it's like the Sweep the Sheds is an articulation of a value. But what it really is it's a culture statement, but thinking culture also is an outcome. So the outcome of this is people feel the way they feel.
Correct.
If someone said, how do you want them to feel? I want them to feel as though they are connected, they are part of something, there's a belonging in it. But you're not exactly – you can't write that into anything other than an idea.
Yep.
And then when it's – when you feel it and you understand it
– yep.
And the challenging thing often, and you probably found this with league footy, is you don't know what it's like without it in some ways, when you haven't got that. Like if you're, when you're involved in a team which has been successful and then all of a sudden isn't successful, or you're part of a team which is not successful now but obviously has a goal to be successful at some point. You sort of know it when you see it and feel it, but you don't quite know, and each dynamic's going to be different.
100%. And it's also from you've got it one day and then you haven't the next. And it's not a, you haven't got it one day and then you have the next. It's gradual in certain things. And so that's the hardest part is to identify it. But we're still doing our meeting the same way we always did it. We're still following through. Mm. We're still there's still accountability. But at times there's just things that drop off that you don't even realize are dropping off because you're in the moment and you're still trying to win the next moment. And that's in business and in sport. And that's, they can learn so much from each other. We've both come from sporting backgrounds and now we're in business, but you still refer back to the lessons you got in sport. And really simple one I'll talk to business people about. So on a Monday for sport, there's 5 different reviews go on for a 2-hour game. So effectively 20% of your whole week is reviewing the 2 hours that you saw on TV, which is your and there's been at least 8 hours per coach has put in, so let's call that minimum 5, so 40 hours of work just to get to the first meeting, which is coaches review together, leadership group reviews together, your midfield backs and forwards review together with their coach. You're reviewed every single play that you're in or every decision that you make or don't make. And then the whole team reviews together. So that's Monday. So you go to, even from a business perspective, you go, how often do you actually look back and review your week previously? Or even, let's break it down, what about your meeting?
How'd the meeting go?
Let's go into a meeting.
Yeah.
So what's the, who had to prepare that meeting? Did everyone have to prepare? Or was it just one person? Did people come unprepared? Once you get to the meeting, what's the agenda? What are the outcomes from that? And then when you get to the end of it, did you review it? And go, all right, did we achieve all the things we set out to achieve?
And you've started doing that with the work you do?
Yeah, we do it in a range of different ways, yeah. So, and also follow-ups in between that. So it's also when you also want to give people almost like, this is the plan of how I would do it, but do it your way. And then let it go for a little bit, and some things will work, some things won't work, and then sometimes you'll step in, and then sometimes you'll try and stay away for certain reasons. Because I think also in sport, you could be the best player in the team and you'll fail heaps of times in that 2-hour period because you make mistakes. Like, that's failure. So you're used to it in sport. So you know you can't have everything perfect. Whereas in business, people are less reluctant to accept the failure or the mistakes to understand that it's just part of the journey. And
it's part of the growth in so many ways. There's a wonderful one, Pat Cummings talk. He says, before they play, as Australian cricket captain, how are we going to fail today?
Yep.
How are we going to fail? And your first thing is, are we going to fail by playing poorly? So, no, if we're going to fail, can we fail playing how we want to play?
Yep.
And so if they're going into a one-day game, we want to be bold, we want to play our strokes, you know, we want to take the game on. Let's not fail not playing our game.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's my sense here is that you want to fail doing the things you know are the right things. Yep. And if you make the mistakes, well, they're just a lesson and we get the opportunity of growing from that.
I just say fail is a bruise, not a tattoo.
Yeah. And I think it's actually, if there is two or three of the main things I've noticed since coming from elite sport into say more corporate business, is almost the shame of business as it relates to failure.
Yeah.
And business is hard, you know. Business is ambiguous, business is nuanced, you know, business is a whole lot of unknown and unknowable things. Well, of course you're gonna fail.
Yep.
You know, we're famously poor at predicting the future. And we come up with a strategy which says this is what the future's gonna tell us. And when the future doesn't tell us that, it's almost like failure. Well, no, we just dust ourselves off and we go again.
And it's usually about, like in sport, one wins and one loses every week.
Yeah. So it's much more binary in that sense.
Compared to a business. But also even in that 1-1, if you win playing poorly, you treat it like a loss almost in terms of the way you review it.
You still got the learnings. The lessons are still there.
Correct. Yeah. Yep.
Even in victory. And so the three questions I always come back to are what happened, what now, what next. Yep. So what happened is your review.
Yep.
And so, because what's happened is the previous hour of the meeting, say, has now given us new data.
Yep.
We got new. How did we interact? How'd the meeting go?
Yep.
You know, did we cover the ground we wanted to cover? You know, have we, you know, We don't seek agreement, but we at least seek alignment, you know, as to which way we're going to go forward. Have we got that? You know, so that's a what happened question based on that. Then we have dialogue around this, not monologue, even though you're the leader. And the way that you described it before is that everyone else has a view, everyone has an opinion. They're the people closer to the action than what you are. It's not monologue, it's dialogue, so it's a proper conversation.
I think just on that, the important one is in the leadership group setting from a football sense, I'd ask the question first to get everyone else's opinion because I didn't want to influence what they would say. Yeah.
So what sort of questions would you ask?
Or anything around so that training drill that we did during the week, the purpose of that was to do this. Do you think that worked and we should go back to it this week or not? And if I say another way of doing it, and there'll be different opinions in it, whereas if I say that one that we did during the week was really good, I want to stick with that again, all of a sudden I've put my opinion onto everyone else and the easiest thing for them to say is, yeah, I agree. Yeah. Like, it's harder to challenge the leader all the time. So even from I used to set guys up at training or in meetings where I'd go, I'm going to come to you with this question, so have your answer ready.
So in a drill?
Yeah, so we'd finish
on the track.
Yep, finish the drill. Everyone comes running into the middle to sort of have your little debrief. And on the way in, I'd mention it to one of the younger players and say, I'm going to come to you. And then everyone would sort of have a bit to say, and the coaches have a bit to say. And then I'd go, actually, yeah, I've got a question. Like, how did you feel about that? And throw it out to the person I've spoken to. And they've had time to think about it, and then they can articulate something that's actually got relevance. Mm. Whereas in the moment, if I said, oh, what do you think? They go, oh, yeah, no, I agree with what everyone else said. Because it's just...
Could be rabbits in the headlight. They could panic.
Correct.
So you're giving them... So you're not setting them up either. So you're getting confidence in them, belief in them. Their voice is important, but you're not setting them up.
No, correct. That's, yep.
And so that would be the classic what happened, what now. So you ask about the drill, and so the what now, is it worthwhile? Do we continue with it? Is it something, or because we also then have to change what next, because we're going to go out on the training track again.
Yep.
You know, it might change the direction we're heading. So it's a really simple framing of it, of just, you know, what happened, what now, what next, data, dialogue, decision as the framing. And the decisions are a what now decision and a what next decision.
I think also part of it is not just thinking your executive team, which is sort of the equivalent to a leadership group, that they have all the answers without those outside of the room.
I think
so often there's people that are with the customers or the clients that actually are a lot closer to the action. You need to make sure you're in touch with them and that they've got a say and that their opinion is valid, because there's certain things that you think your business wants to be. And we've adapted a lot of different things over the last sort of 6 to 12 months where we thought it would be a certain way, but it hasn't been. So, and all that's come from member feedback and through staff feedback, not through our executive board thinking that we know a certain way, because we're not the ones in the trenches all the time.
Yeah,
and I think it's really important to be doing that and to find that out. So even the way from a leadership group where you talk to the younger players who aren't involved basically outside of the first few training sessions, we're all together, and then you break out and go to your captain's run, and they break out and go to their VFL captain's run that night or whatever. What's that experience like? How's that going for you? How do you feel the improvement coming? Do you feel that training session goes well? Like, so there's all these other things that a senior player would never know. And then the senior players don't even realise the influence they can have by going down to Williamstown on a Sunday afternoon when it's sleet coming sideways off the ocean and just going out at quarter time and just giving the guy a pat on the back and going, mate, love what you're doing, keep working.
Yeah,
like that little moment like that.
It means the world. Because it's easy, even though you're in an elite environment or any work environment, to feel irrelevant. Yeah. And you can feel so distant from where the real action is actually happening.
Yep.
So I always had a little saying, no one's irreplaceable and no one's irrelevant.
Yep.
You know, because some people can be seen as having such status in the organisation that, you know, we can't get on without them.
Yep.
And, you know, history's full of that not being true.
Correct, yes.
But a terrible place to be, and I think we've all felt it at different times, is that somehow you're irrelevant to, you know, what's important in this place.
Yep.
And how you go about it. I'd like to just explore a little bit more of the captaincy piece with you, you know, and even this idea of how your form improved. Did you, when you stepped into that role, and you were part of probably the initial generation, probably Stuart Maxfield at the Swans was a little bit this, where you come into the role as not the best player in the team. You know,
Harley was someone I looked up
to. Tom Harley, very much that. Yeah, so the great example of people who had sort of leadership bestowed on them.
Yep.
And I think in Tom Harley's case, he also improved as a player.
Oh, he was All-Australian. He was a critical part of multiple premierships.
Yeah, yeah. And Maxie, because I knew him from the Richmond days, and, you know, he came through as the ultimate blood, if you like, and really started, you know, that what has been probably the oldest of the leadership traditions now, you know, probably 25, 30 years old. So to come in and actually have questions around your own game, but still have to lead.
Yep.
And so had, you know, the potential of losing confidence in your game and at the same time still having to, you know, run through the banner, take a team up the race in front of 100,000 people, 80,000 people.
Yeah. Well, I think I had a bit of a rough start in 2009 where I'd had a great pre-season, everything was going well. And then I was suspended at a bump over in West Coast and unfortunately had a head clash that broke Paddy McGinnity's jaw.
Right.
And I was suspended for a month for that, and we fought it and got off because actually the prosecutor said, you laid the perfect bump. You put your arm down, your shoulder in, you lowered your weight. Mm. And yet we acknowledge through the doctor's reports, because I'd bang on my head that it was a head clash, but they were saying you've got a duty of care, which came in after that.
Yeah,
was,
which you would have now.
Yes, yeah. Correct. Now you'd be gone. Yeah, so you wouldn't even try and bump now with the situation I was in. So we got over that and then played the first couple of weeks.
So that was a fairly big distraction.
Yeah.
So you've had to turn a four-week suspension. So you're basically, your head's only into that issue at that point.
Yep. And then
I think people underestimate that, by the way.
Oh, God. You know, especially when
it's almost legal. Yeah. It's so out of your own world, isn't it? You know, you got these intelligent people debating all this stuff.
I was suspended, go to the tribunal on the Tuesday, and then it was upheld, and then we fought again. So I was the first one out of, I think, 11 previously that actually got off on the next slot.
So it took your whole week up, basically.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And then the next week was round one. Yeah. So I didn't play well in the first 2 weeks, and then I copped a 2 week suspension for what wasn't even a bump. It was just a check on Stevie Johnson. He just turned around and run back, and I stood in front of him, and he went down. Then as Stevie does, bounced up and chased me and wrestled me, and but I didn't even think anything of it. And they'd given me 2 weeks, and it was sort of, I couldn't get out of it the way they'd shaped the suspension, which I think was payback for the one before that. Mm. But I sat down with Mick, and he said,
Mick Malthouse,
and he goes, just remember, the reason that you're named captain was because of who you are, not who we want you to be. So don't try and be someone else. Don't think that we think you're going to grow into someone else as a person, as a player. Mm. We think that who you are is the captain that we need right now. And so that gave me confidence to go take away. You try not to hear things, but I knew people were saying, how's your captain? He's not even the best 22. He's not even close. Like, how, he's the worst captain of all time, all that type of thing. So you can't help but hear those things as you're trying to focus on what's important. Mm. And to hear it from my coach at that time was a really important moment for me, and came back after 2 weeks and basically was all Australian that year. So it changed the way that I played, getting that confidence. So yeah, it certainly improved me as a player and the way that I went about it. The leadership stuff wasn't so much, that came naturally, as I said, so I didn't know
you,
any different.
You say that, and I reckon you're not giving yourself any credit. Because there's certain aspects of it I imagine would come naturally.
Yeah.
But you still had some pretty senior guys in your squad and all that sort of stuff at that stage. And you had a few scallywags as well.
Yep.
You had the residual of the Rat Pack was still in the system.
That was less than residual. They were nice
at their peak.
But I think also with that, it's, when I say it came natural, is because they all knew who I was and the relationships I'd built with everyone.
Yeah.
So it was, I appreciated what they did and who they were and that they went about it a little bit differently. And like, those guys will to win and will to train hard and have a high standard around football was second to none. Mm. And so I think that even at different stages for me, if there was something coming up that I knew might rock the boat a little bit, a decision from the club or a certain thing that we had to do as a team because of appearances or anything at all, I'd go and seek counsel of a few of those guys and go, listen, this is coming up. I just want to get an idea of what you guys think. These are our options in front of us. So like, bring them in and include them, because like, they weren't in the leadership group as such, but their leadership was so important to what we did.
They had influence.
100%, yeah. As players, as number one.
Yeah.
In standards and the way we trained and what we did as a team, number two. But number three, they had great relationships with everyone as well. So they had, again, they knew things and heard things and hung out in groups that I didn't hang out in, like outside of the change rooms. So it was really important to have, you've got a captain, but you've got 10 to 12 probably people that have massive importance in your team and where you're going as a group.
Yeah. It's interesting because often you say, who are the leaders? If I ask people, say, in a team, who are the leaders, they'll go, him, and him.
Yep.
Or she, her, and her.
Yep.
Okay, now tell me who are the most influential people in the room.
Yeah.
And often it's different.
Yep.
And a lot of the – if you can't win the trust of the most influential people, and it's a different form of trust.
Yes.
It's a – you know, the danger I found, and I only say this because I stuffed it up, and stuffed it up pretty badly at one point, was the capacity to meet people where they're at rather than you expect them to meet you where you're at.
Yep.
And so, say the Rat Pack, yep. if you like, it's an identity which was actually given. But as you said, they train hard, work hard, play yep. hard, and do all the things that, you know, there are moments where some aspects of what you would like them to be are compromised,
yep.
you know, and you're wishing certain things weren't happening.
Yep.
And the interesting thing in the NFL, they often separate personal character from football character.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So their football character is probably pretty high.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some questions, little questions on some of the aspects of their choices they're making and beyond
I think with that though, you've got to take the good with the bad. Like you can't expect certain things of people and then just expect them to be perfect over here as well. Like everyone's got their good and bad things in their personality and the way they go about it. Mm. So even with those guys, quite often it would be they'd also break the ice.
Mm.
Like you can't have all serious guys that all just want to win in terms of a football team.
Mm.
So even with Mick, you'd see at different stages he's fired up and he's talking to the group and then he sure would say something or Dida could say something that's hilarious and the whole room would like break the ice, they'd all start laughing. So and it would just change the
and,
way
and that Mick would go with that. He wouldn't get angry. 100%. He wouldn't get
He'd love it.
Well, Mick, I know Mick Malthouse is famous for his demeanour as the hard man, but he was actually famous for being a practical joker when he was a player.
Yeah. And as a coach, don't worry about that. But he probably used others more than doing it himself.
Right.
So he'd go, he'd set it up. And when he had guys like Blue McKenna as his assistant coaches, and that was easier to do.
Yeah, that's right. So he could play it off a little bit. So your form improved, and so even the way you talk about now, some of the things that you did, were they always evolving, or was that something that where did the concepts come from, the ideas come from for you to say, well, I'm actually going to captain this very much in my own image, having been given the confidence and belief of Mick. Where then does some of the ideas and thinking come from around, say, well, I'm going to bring this young person into the training session by asking him a question? Was that you're always just seeking stuff?
I think for that, it was part of my development in that, and every leader, particularly in a sporting club, has felt this where you realise it's the same people talking and then you're like, oh, God, if we can't have this, like if I'm taken out of this room for whatever reason, who's going to talk? And I felt that. I felt I was talking too much and that because I knew I had all the answers. I knew what the game plan was. I knew every single situation that might show up that Mick would go, all right, what are we doing in this? I knew what the answer would be.
Mm. So you knew the playbook.
I knew it all, yeah. And I knew what – I watched every opposition player and how they went about it. I knew people go, who was the best player ever played? And I go, well, Buddy Franklin. And that's an obvious answer because he was so good.
Mm.
But he was also so good because he knew Sammy Mitchell was left foot, right foot and was more of a 25-meter kick, was his most comfortable kick.
Mm.
I knew that Roughhead would come out. He was – basically 95% left foot but very upright and wanted to kick in a straight line, not around corners.
Mm.
I knew Cyril could kick it anywhere, but yeah, always on his left foot, but he could kick it back that way when most left footers couldn't. So leading patterns and how Buddy created the space was because he knew up the field what those guys were doing, how those kicks were coming in. So having studied every single bit, because I couldn't fall back on the ability of a Buddy. I had to know, I defined 1% on, all right, if this guy's got the ball, How do I take 1% of that space away? How do I gain a meter there?
So how did you study that? It was just video,
just vision over and over. Conversations
with a coach. With a coach.
Sometimes, but a lot of it myself. But yeah, sometimes you'd be with a coach. Even when we frame like backs meetings, we'd go in and go, righto, well, how do they score? Will they score from stoppage most of the time? Will they score from turnover? Or whatever it is, and they're a set shot team, so their marks inside 50's high. Mm. All right, well, we need to be really good in the air, so we need to be third man across to help support the guy so he's not one-on-one.
Yeah.
Or if it was their smalls are really good ground ball players, so it had to be our spoils had to clear the area, so it was harder for them to have an influence. And then our defenders had to make sure we were – you can only stand on one of two sides when the ball comes in on an opponent. You can't stand behind them because they're off. If you stand in front of them, you can't see them, so you don't know where they're going. So you're either left or right. So when the ball comes into that that contest, you either need to be moving them to the left or moving them to the right, depending on where the ball's come from, so where you expect that spoil to go or where those drops are going to be. So, and that's all just about buying yourself time, really. It's to hopefully get more of your defenders down there to be able to get out of there. So, there's sort of a lot of layers to understanding And that's only stuff you get if you really want to get better. I really want more knowledge.
That's what I'm hearing, because it's obviously available to everyone.
Yeah.
So one of the things we often talk about is that the where sport's great is it builds off feedback. You know, we do that. So there's no lack of it. In fact, there's arguably way too much of it in some ways, and it becomes just noise if we're not careful. But then you're going actually in search of your own version of that, because there the specifics of your game and you also know your own limitations and in regard to that. So the opportunity to, one, fully express as a leader, but also take full responsibility for your own game and your role in the team, and what, you're 24, 25 years of age, or maybe a little bit old.
Yes, 5 or 6, when
it's And we often get reminded by psychologists that the male brain doesn't kick in until it's about 25. And we've all experienced that as well. In relation to even so the team you have here, those ideas of taking responsibility and then giving them the space, is that now forming in regard to how you go about it as a leader here? Do you coach as leader, do you think, here?
I think I probably coach through – a lot of it's through how I go about it every day myself. So they see what I do and how I go about it. Mm. So I think that's part of it. But I think the other part is around giving a lot of feedback on when things are going well and when things aren't taking responsibility for that. So when things haven't worked, so
it's normalising feedback in some ways,
It's also making people feel safe to realise we're going to stuff it up, we're going to get things wrong, but it's not. I remember having a conversation with someone around this, and I said, "What's the worst that could happen?" I said, "Oh, it could cost us $5,000." Mm. I said, "Well, it wouldn't cost us $5,000." Yeah, we'd lose $5,000. Mm. I said, "No, that'd be that $5,000." Would be us learning about what our members want. It'd be an investment in us trying to understand who we are and what we are.
Yeah.
And she said, "What, so you wouldn't be angry?" And I was like, "I'd only be angry if you just plucked it out of the hat and go, this is what we're doing." Mm. But I know you put in a lot of planning, a lot of preparation, a lot of thought into just trying to create what that is. And if we go back and we review that and we got all that right and it just didn't work, that's an investment in us going, okay, that's not going to work next time. We either scrap that idea or we need to do it differently. But it's okay to make those mistakes. And that's where, when you're a new business, you've got a lot to learn. And that's probably,
the mistakes are going to be so valuable.
Yeah. And that's from a sport perspective. You go, your week is so, like, you end up getting to a point where you don't really learn much. You're just in that circle of review, prepare for training. So review on a Monday, prepare on the Tuesday for the training on the Wednesday, do your match committees, go on a Wednesday, your main training session, Thursday's off, Friday's your captain's run, Saturday's your game.
Mm.
And it's just that same cycle all the way through for the majority of it. I've learned stuff this morning that I had no idea about in business, because there's something different that comes at you every single day. And it's good from a perspective of, all right, well, we need to find a solution to that. Let's go do it. Like, what are we going to do? And then actually being able to spitball, spend more time in front of a whiteboard than I've ever had before, because get a chance to throw things up. And I think a lot of it is around showing how I think to a lot of my staff, but then allowing them to do their own, have their own guidance on it. And I think also you don't, as a leader, you actually have to let people fail, because as you mentioned earlier, you learn more from your failures. Yeah. So sometimes you go, well, here's a process. How do we go through that process? Oh, we failed. Then you go back and go, right, well, was the process wrong, or was how we actually put it together on the day and how we implemented that, was that what was wrong? So
So the growth can be, it's actually recognising that also we've got to become comfortable with the discomfort of that moment, if you like, because it's going to happen. If you're going to take any form of responsibility, there's the discomfort of the mistake, the discomfort of not knowing. There's all forms of discomfort, and human nature is that we avoid discomfort.
Yep.
That's in any form. And I think that we all deal with that, say, in training, getting fitter, getting healthier, whatever it might be. But the discomfort of a mistake then has the potential of ideas around shame, which are really powerful. Brown stuff just shows the power of that. that if we're not careful, and I think sport transitioned from a shame environment because of, I think, say, my generation did grow up with a lot of that. You were shamed if you made a mistake, even by the coach.
Yep.
And there were some, you know, there's famous examples of that.
Yep.
Whereas to an environment where, yeah, you could get a pretty tough message.
Yeah. And I think it's also understanding who, what people's role is and what they're good at and what they're not.
Yeah. Like
there's a ton of things I'm not good at and I don't get involved in it. I'll ask questions,
yeah,
but I don't get involved in it because I don't know it. Whereas it's like, I remember one day Scotty Pendlebury went back with a flight into a leading full forward and got crunched.
Mm.
And I picked him up and said, young kid, I said, mate, that was unbelievable. Like, well done. I said, don't ever fucking do it again.
Exactly.
And he sort of looked at me like, what do you mean? I said, because there is that when it's your time to go.
Yeah.
When it's your time to go in certain elements. But I tell you what, he went back in the wrong direction and got absolutely crunched. And he's one of our best players. I said, leave that to me. That's my role is to go back and do that stuff. I don't need like the Rolls Royce getting dinged up.
Yeah.
I need you going out and win the ball. So when people will say,
you're the old Holden, mate. And you're
correct. I've got dints everywhere, trust me. But I think that's, you want to set people up for success and what's going to be best for your team.
Yeah.
Well, what's best for the team is, I mean, if there's a minute to go in the game and that was a critical one, yeah, I need you to go.
Mm.
But if that was in the first 5 minutes of the game and I need you to run out the whole game and get your 30 and kick a couple like you do, you're no good to us on the bench because you've just been crunched doing that. So there's sort of, there is layers to what you need to do. And I think that comes back to leadership because I see even from a business sense, and football's exactly the same. If we had made Swanee captain instead of me, then what type of an impact, I don't think he would have been anywhere near the player that he was on the field because he would have had to do all the other stuff off the field.
Yeah.
And you have people-
would have loaded him up and-
Correct.
Yeah.
And you have people who are great. So your best salesperson in your business. Because they're so good at what they do, automatically you're always looking for, okay, well, we need to promote them. So we're going to promote them into this role now and they're going to manage the sales team.
Mm.
All of a sudden, it's not about them doing the selling. It's about them helping everyone else do the selling and managing them and managing everything they're going through and coaching them on things. That's a completely different role.
Totally. Yeah.
So too often in business, I see we promote someone into a role because they're brilliant at it.
Yeah.
When in fact, we should be saying, nah, you are so critical to what we do. We're going to pay you more and give you more influence in what you do. But understand that if we put you up to this point, this is what it could look like. Mm. And all of a sudden they lose their confidence. They're not selling. The business isn't going so well.
You lose your best salesperson, you get a poor leader.
Correct. Yeah.
Often, yeah.
Yep.
And there is a natural aspect of it because at the same time you want the person to have the aspiration. You want the person to have the ambition. And so I found this a really difficult place.
Yep.
And so I made exactly the mistake that you're making. And I think I did that even with my own career.
Yep.
I went from a recruiting manager and had just – started really, I was only 23 or 24, just started to make a little bit of a name for myself and then all of a sudden I get the opportunity of being a CEO. And I spent the CEO my first year trying to be someone else, really, and try to play a game I'd never played before in my life and the hardest job I've ever done in my life.
Yep.
And it was, again, through the wisdom of a person close to me said, well, what made you good at the recruiting thing? And I was quite strategic. Yep. I was good on the talent ID. I was able to sell the story, as in, you know, convince the player to come and play for our club.
Yep.
I was good at looking after them when they came into the club. Well, there's a whole leadership game built around that. Correct. So I just totally changed the way I wanted to lead. So I became CEO, but really that was the skills I'd evolved as a recruiter, which were the natural ones that I, you know, and because the rest of it, you know, one of the greatest lot of bullshit in life is fake it till you make it because you know you just lose confidence every time you open your mouth if you're faking it. Whereas I could actually talk strategically about the future of the organisation the way I could talk strategically about the future of the club. It's the same conversation.
Yep.
It's just a different area. And selling a sponsorship wasn't that much different to convincing a player to come and play for your club.
Yep.
It's a similar sort of way of thinking. And I think we can, if we build our leadership game initially around the stuff that we're good at, we're just a much better chance of not losing confidence.
100%.
And the other idea is, I think it was, we're never quite ready anyway. You only get your confidence by doing something.
Yep.
You can't wait to be ready to in fact do it. And so because I made a meal of it, I'm now actually really conscious of the fact we have to coach people into those roles and then support people in those roles as well.
I think the hardest part about it is there's no There's no Super Bowl, there's no premiership to leadership.
No.
There's no medal for leadership.
I think you can hear about that. It's a never-ending, isn't it? Correct. It's without a finish line. Yeah.
100%. So you can have the greatest moment, leadership moment you've ever had and walk out of it and completely stuff up the next one. There's all different moments that come at you, and that's the hardest part, is that from a leadership perspective, you can be really good and then the next day you can be shocking.
Or there's no acknowledgement of it all, and they're only in your quiet moments. I can remember times driving home and a little smile would come on my face, and so I think that was actually...
Yeah.
There was the outcome that we achieved today actually had its origins way back with a piece of thinking a long time ago. And I found that particularly with the development of people where, you'd actually worked hard to convince them there was something in them they hadn't seen of themselves at that point. And then you get to actually see it, playing out in a high stakes way.
And there's a lot of people would have got a lot
of pride from watching you, I think, in that sense.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. And that was always, when I retired, I went and got a frame made, a signed picture and personalised message to about 25 people who had had a massive impact on it, going back to 18. Because they have an influence, and I know that they would have got a kick out of watching you play.
Yeah.
I think it's also, when you look at it from a leadership perspective, there's also what type of leadership do they need in that moment? So I remember from some of our defenders had been called out for not going back with a flight in the right when it was their time to go.
Called out by?
Just by media and all that.
So the external stuff.
Yeah. And it was actually, I knew them as individuals, had nothing to do with their courage. It was actually technical in terms of their technique.
Right.
So I remember we had this big brick wall at the club, and we just put this like thick foam over the front of it, and we'd run from sort of 10 metres away and jump and turn the body and have the impact into your glute rather than like these guys have been running back.
Yeah,
and it's front where they're going to get kneed straight in the guts, and no one wants that.
No.
So it was actually a technical thing. So we just spent all this time practicing that.
Yeah.
And then their confidence grew, and all of a sudden they're, now I know how to do this. So it was not about the courage factor. Yeah.
So technique in... for example, ways of handling an uncomfortable conversation.
Yep.
Yeah. So, like, even ideas around feedback, because feedback's so normalised in sport. But if you're not careful, feedback becomes noise as well. So, in that way, I always think of feedback. First question: can you back it up? Second question: is it important? Third question: is it coming from a good place?
Yep.
Well, if you actually write those things down, you've just developed a technique by which you now have a confidence and belief that, you can give this feedback because it can actually answer those questions for yourself. If you can't answer those questions for yourself, you shouldn't be giving the feedback in the first place.
100%,
so it's just hearsay. It's something other than feedback, at that time. And so what you're doing in that moment is actually all three, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a way of doing this. This is not talking to your courage, it's talking to your technique.
Yep.
That's a very different conversation.
100%, yeah.
Very different.
And I think a lot of the conversations you can actually, if you set them out as conversations, then it changes the whole, it takes the sort of pressure off what's about to happen. Because if you're CEO and you call someone in for a meeting, they're like, what's this all about type thing straight away. So all of a sudden they're on edge. You go, no, I just want to discuss some things that have been going on. So talk to me about how things are going, how do you feel, and then I'll throw something out. Like I might be, you realise that if we go about something in this way, like what type of an impact would that have on what we're trying to do here? And then they'll go, that would have a negative impact, obviously, because of this, and this. And go, so they've actually just come up with the answer that instead of me just going in and telling them, they've come up with the answer. I remember with Craig Bellamy, my first year, so obviously going to
a storm,
going to a storm, different sport, and there was a bit about that players weren't certain on their role and on what was really important in their role, and they've been a bit just sort of fuzzy around some things. So I want to do something, and I need you to trust me.
This is a game you've never, you'd know very little about.
I went in, so on that point, I thought it was five tackles, put in a kick. How easy is this? I sat at my first meeting and I was that embarrassed. I knew like the five tackles was right and that was it. I didn't know anything else. Yeah. And we're down the lawn on this camp, and I've split up the fullbacks, the wings, the forwards, the centers, etc. I've split them all up into their groups. I said, I want you to come back and present to the team what you think are the three most important things for you to do your role on the weekend. So it all went off of their butcher's paper and did it all, and then someone would get up and they'd present it, and there'd be a bit of back and forth. I see number three there. Have you thought about X, Y, and Z instead? Mm. Yeah, we did talk about them, but we thought if we did this, then those ones wouldn't be relevant anyway. Mm. So they went through it all. Mm. They put them all up on the wall, and I said, right, thanks, boys, and the players left. And I said to Craig and the other coaches, what do you think? Would you change anything up there? And they went, nah. Mm. I said, the power, though, is that they came up with it, not us. Mm. We didn't tell them. Mm. They already know. They know it. All we need to do now is to actually just guide it and just keep coaching it. So what we did was we had massive wall in the team meeting and every single position just had those three things. Mm. So they had to rate their game every week, and it was a public way of doing it. Mm. But they'd rate their game against those three things. Mm. And so if they did them, they'd give themselves out of 10, and we had a little rating system. Mm. But then it also allowed the reserve team who played up in the Q Cup. So the senior boys never watch them play because they're playing, obviously.
Same time.
Yeah, and different states every time.
Yeah.
So they would know their role. So it's a fullback rating against a fullback. And so Billy Slater could go, I noticed whoever the fullback playing Q Cup is, I see that you only gave yourself a six. What were the things you messed up on? And he goes, I was no good with this. He goes, well, let's do a little bit after training on it.
Right.
So it actually became, it allowed feedback and support from the senior players back within to those boys.
So the coaches are coaching, the players are coaching.
Yep.
That's powerful. There's almost different responses I think you can have as a leader in those situations. So if someone comes to you, are they just sort of, you're a sounding board. Yeah. Yep. In that moment, I'm just a sounding board.
Yep.
And I go, I'm going to be that for you.
Yep.
You just want to bounce something off me. Yeah, cool. Yep. Sounds like a good idea. The second one is almost they're coming to you with something, but they're actually almost wanting confidence from you.
Yep.
Yeah, you've done some really good work. Go with it. I think you've done all the work now. Bang, go with it. The third one's a little bit different. There might be, I'm not sure about this. I'm going to have to, can I go dig into your thinking? It's almost like David Parkin calls it the critical friend.
Yep.
The one where we seem to have lost this bit along the way. Can we actually now? And the fourth one I reckon is almost a partnering approach.
Yep.
Yeah, let's work this one out together.
Yeah.
And so almost in some ways, if I'm hearing it, I'll go through those sort of framings of it.
Yep.
Am I being the soundboard? Am I being the encourager? Am I being the critical friend? Am I being, the person who's going to partner?
Yep.
Because the partner might be, we're going to take it way back, we're going to do it, but now you'll be able to do it on your own. That type of thing. And I got that framework from Rick Rubin, actually, the music producer. Because even with musicians, it sounds great.
I think
that one's ready. Yeah. The encourager might be, I think you've done the work, mate. If we do any more work on this, you're just going to overwork it.
Yep.
And it's funny how you get your little pieces of knowledge and information from really – he's almost a coach of the band.
Yep.
He's the coach of the Red Hot Chili Peppers in that moment.
And I think it's also depends on how big the decision is.
Yeah.
So you want to work out, is this a decision we need to solve right now, or is it
big,
something
big for you or big for them?
Well, both.
Yeah.
So, and that's there's one I got from Jeff Walsh when I was working sort of 2IC almost to him, and he said
he's at footy manager.
Footy manager. Yeah. So when I retired and I was back in an operations role, and feedback time. All right. Yep. Where are we at? Yeah. Good. And I said, well, give me some feedback. And he said, the only one I give you is, you're a problem solver and you like to solve the problem as soon as you can so you can move on to the next one.
Yeah.
And he goes, buy yourself some time. He goes, because
I still think you got a bit of that about you.
I probably do, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also, I've definitely taken on a lot of that where, all right, is this something I have to solve right now, or is this something I can think about? Give me an hour. Yeah. And he'd go, well, in an hour's time, you'll think about it differently than what you do right now in this moment, and by tomorrow, you'll think about it a lot differently. So if you can afford to buy yourself till tomorrow, then you can come back with a clear mind, no emotion attached to it, and actually go through and work through what that problem should, how it should be solved. So,
Do you record your thoughts at the time though? So like, for instance, just a little note to yourself saying,
I'm currently
thinking this, and then I'll come back to my note tomorrow. Yep.
So I'll either write it in notes in my phone,
or
if it's an email that I'm going to send at some stage, I'll write it and leave it in my draft.
Right, okay.
So I won't send
it. That's a good system.
Because I want to go back onto it.
Yeah.
So I think from that perspective, it's just – and it's something that's been great advice for me because it's completely different. So
I'm really pleased you got that because it can be – we feel that we're being rewarded for velocity often. Yep. You know, there's one of my favourite lines is velocity is never the answer for complexity, you know.
Yes.
But we're used to going quick,
yep.
You know, and our world, the world's going way quick. We think it's going quicker than what it actually is. You can, it's yep. like Scott Pendlebury, the player who can slow the game down,
yeah,
you know, yep. the leader who can slow the game down. Do we have to make this call now? You know,
yeah, correct.
As long as it's not yeah. procrastinating yeah. or, you know, but there is just, you know, often it's 24 hours between a,
yep.
a good decision and a bad decision.
And even the influence of, so when you're talking to a staff member who's come to you with that problem, as an example, mm. you go, okay, well, in that instant, what sort of a flow-on effect will that have short-term, medium-term, long-term? Mm. So if we went, righto, we want to commit to a partnership with mm. with a certain company,
yeah.
then I go, well, hang on. From my perspective, when I'm having conversations about certain things,
mm.
I don't want to lock us into that right now because in 6 months' time, we might have to tear it up or yeah. or we're locked into yeah. something that makes it limits our decisions further down the track.
Yeah, short-term, long-term.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, and particularly when if we're not careful, for people who may have not had a win for a while as well, people yeah. are looking for it. The thing I was interested in having a conversation was the idea of connection, a leader as connection, and I feel a really strong sense of that.
Yep.
Here, there's some great footage I saw from the Swans. I don't know if you've seen it recently, where they've actually tried to build ideas of connection into on field, which seems okay. obvious.
Yep.
But it might be, for instance, a player saying, look, I just can't get into the game.
Yep.
Can you get me a kick?
Yep.
I just need to feel the ball. I need to
yep.
know where I'm at. You know, it might be a good player, might have, you know. And because I think of that as being like almost ultimate courage in regard to tell one of your teammates yeah. you're actually struggling. We talk about that in life, you yep. know, as in, you know, tell your friend you're struggling with your health, mental yep. health or whatever it might be. But this is in the 2 hours of the cauldron
yep.
and to say, I just can't get a kick here.
Yep.
Does that surprise you that those sorts of conversations are starting to happen?
No. I feel like we'd have a lot of those where, so yeah. in particular, Swanee or Pendle's getting tagged.
Yeah.
Right, go take the kick out. Or
right,
come down here. As soon as I take a mark, run past me.
Yeah.
And I'll give it to you, put on a block for you.
Yeah.
Just all those little things because we knew who we wanted to have in the game.
Yeah.
And even we'd get for about 3 years there, a defensive forward would come down and either be for myself or for Heeshaw or for Heritier. Mm. And we go, righto, we'd just wait for him to come down. And then all the six forwards would go and attack one of us. And yeah. we go, righto, we know who it is.
Yeah.
So every chance we could, we'd just give him the ball.
Would a player actually say, look, I'm struggling on the ground?
Yeah, yep. You would have, I just can't get near it. I just can't get myself involved. So that would definitely happen, yeah. So
yeah, that's probably good. I just yeah. felt that might have been almost that pride thing sort yep. of kicks in a little yep. bit, particularly when we're talking the good players,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
who
yeah.
are used to, you know, you see games where Lachie Neale, you know, didn't get a kick in the first quarter, he's yep. used to getting it 15 times in a quarter or something like
yep.
something like that. And even with all of their great achievement and their confidence and their belief, to not get the hands on the footy or to have, you yep. know, in that moment to actually say, look, I'm struggling a bit
here. Yeah.
I'm not going.
And I think also the great thing about sport is that you can actually put them in a different role that changes what their mindset is. So it's not yeah. about getting the ball.
Yeah.
And it's not about what's been taken away from them. So
mm.
even just saying, righto, whichever player it is, Lockie, all right, so-and-so is getting a hold of the opposition. I want you mm. to go and play on him. Or I want you to go to full forward and we're going to clear out the whole forward 50.
Yeah, go one-on-one.
Because you'll beat him one-on-one down there.
Because yeah, we trust him. Yeah. Yeah.
Just trying to find. Mm. And that's the role of the coaches also to see that because often they'll see it before the player does because the player's got that pride in them in, I'll work through this. I'll get myself in the game. They've got such a great self-belief, particularly the champions. Sometimes the coach almost has to take it out of their hands and go, I want you to go and do this for us.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. How would that potentially play out with your team now?
I think we're probably pretty good at having different ideas and hearing yeah. different ideas and learning along the lines of that.
So if your sales
yep.
aren't just you've had a week where sales just haven't been what they are, and
yep.
the people responsible for that are just struggling.
Yep. Well, I think it's also we review it. Like we have there's probably, let's say, 8 different meetings that go on per week with different departments, and we know what we're there to achieve, and we know that it's not all smooth sailing. So having the senior enough people in those rooms to be able to talk through what we're trying to do here, but also what are the things that we're not going to negotiate on? What are the things we're not going to change? So from an operations perspective, it's all right, well, these are the things we need to capture from a like social media or vision or whatever it is we need to capture. So, and here's the opportunities we're going to have in front of us. What are the events we've got? Are they catered events? Are they not catered events? Like, there's so many layers to the things you need, even just the staffing that you need for different, like you've got peak times and non-peak times. And so I think it's just about consistently having those meetings to be able to go through it and basically just spitball whatever you need to spitball for that coming week, because there's going to be things that, as I said, get thrown at us, that, particularly with a newer business that you've never thought about.
Never considered.
Yeah, I had no idea that we've had Mecca, Collingwood Footy Club, Cook Eye, Basketball Australia, Melbourne Storm, Carlton Footy Club. I had no idea that all these big companies were looking for offsites for their executives and for their coaching groups and all that to get away from the club or from the head office. And the way that that wasn't even any thought and part of our membership base, because we just thought it wouldn't happen. But then we're getting all these calls from these people that go, oh, no, this is amazing. Like, we want you guys to do all the catering for us. Literally all we have to do is say, this is how many people, this is what we want, and it's just done. And we know the service is going to be great and the facilities are great, and we don't have anyone knocking on the door going, sorry, I just got one question for you, or can you just take this one call, whereas you do when you're in the normal office?
Well, you can do an offsite here without going massively offsite. Like, you can actually, you know, you can, we think of an offsite getting on a plane or getting in a car and driving for 2.5 hours or something along those lines, where you can do that here and people can be home to tuck their kids into bed.
Correct.
Know? So you can have a lot of the advantage of. I think it's a great part of
your offering. And that's something that we just never thought would be something that we would need or do, because these big companies, they've got tons of meeting rooms and all that type of thing. So
no, they need to get out into a different environment, a different place. And I think you putting your head in and saying, look, I can do 10 minutes with you, 15 minutes with you, if that helps, or whatever, is really a big part of that. Is in terms of, talk to me through failure.
Yep.
Like, when you, was there a time where you just thought, I don't think I can come back from this?
I think every time you get overlooked for something, then you're particularly growing up, you're not picked for that team. I think it's always the way I sort of, my first half of my career, I'll call it, but almost from the age of 15, when you were not making any of those teams, I was always, I'll prove them wrong. So up until about 25, 26, it was about proving people wrong. And then once I got to that point, I flipped it, and it was about proving people right.
Because
then I'd had so many people that believed in me and trusted me, like, to be made captain of Collingwood Footy Club. That took a lot of balls for a lot of people to make that decision, because
and
I wasn't.
Your mum and dad, the people, your mates who'd believed in you. And I really love that take.
Because I wasn't about, for all them, if that was wrong and I wasn't the right person, then it's a failure of the coaches and the board and all those type of people that selected me to do that job. So I wanted to prove them right, that they made the right call, and because they'd put such trust in me. And then obviously, as you say, all your family, all your friends, everyone that supported you and believed in you, you want to prove that they're right, because no doubt at the pub there'd be someone there who'd have a say, and and you've got people there who are in your corner saying, nah, don't you worry about him, he's the right one. So, that was sort of the two different ways I faced it.
If you'd been a prove people right person at 18, would you have still got through?
No chance.
Is that right? So that was, you needed that, almost the anger, is it? Was it anger?
Yep. Yeah. So I'd... I only had a year at North Ballarat, but Jared Fitzgerald, the famous coach down in the VFL.
Coached a million premierships.
He was the best. So Fitzy, we're actually, as a VFL team, they'd spent all this money on tapes, so you could actually watch your tape on a Monday night, which was something that was, for VFL, was just, you didn't really see that at that stage. And I'd go in with him, sit with him, watch my vision go through it all, and then I'd already picked out who was the AFL listed player that we were coming against the next week that I wanted to play on. So I'd go, I want him, because he was on the AFL list and I wasn't. So he had what I didn't have. So I had to show every single week, that guy shouldn't be on there, I should be on there. So it was about, and that wasn't I'll play on the VFL listed player, which is probably more to the point of, you would think you'd be a better chance of beating them than an AFL listed player. I was like, no way, he's got what I want, I'm taking it away from him. And that was, I had a conversation with a young defender from Collingwood a few weeks ago, and I said, mate, the thing that you've got to work out is you're the most diligent player. You do everything right. You're a ripping kid, like marry your daughter type guy. Mm. I said, but when you go out in that field, it literally has to be life or death for you. Mm. You have to go, that person over there in that jumper is taking food off your table. And you actually have to go with that approach. Some don't have to, but in his instance, he does.
Mm.
So,
can you coach that?
Can you coach that?
Can you coach effort?
I think you can. Yeah, no, I think you can. Less effort and more almost grit, because you can practice it. So I'm coaching the under-12s at Williamstown.
Yeah.
And even at training, I'll say, so if our defenders are just standing there with their hands in their pockets next to the forwards, what are you doing? Put your hand on them. Push them around. Make it hard for them. Move them. Take a meter off them. And then I'll go to the forwards. Don't let them touch you. Move around. Keep moving around. So you just
ring a Rosie on the train.
Correct. Yeah. You're just trying to teach them these little moments that become habit. And that's where even on the field, so part of my habit was we'd win a centre bounce and the ball would go into our forward line and you'd hear, the whole stand would hear me go, Swanee, Ling, right, Pendles, Selwood, straight ahead. Mm. So they knew, oh yeah, don't just watch the ball go in.
Mm.
Switch on, where are we going type thing.
And you've got a different view of the game as well from where you're. Yeah.
100%, yeah. And that was even when we played, like we're playing in front of 80, 90,000 people and you couldn't hear, we as defenders learnt to keep looking to locate each other to be able to have almost sign language, like, yeah, you're good, or swap opponents, swap opponents, or you're on the wrong side of him, get around the other side of him, and you're sort of always trying to work out those things and it became a sign language. And then even when we were, so we went through the whole interchange thing where we had 150 interchange. Mm. The backs almost never went off to allow that to happen for the rest of.
All of a sudden, the backs are running further than any other player on the field. Yeah. I remember there was a game, I was at Fremantle, Luke McFarlane did like an 18K game or something like that at full back. Yeah.
So the way we manage it, we'd swap opponents to give each other a rest out on the ground. So if you're a higher defender, or like go back for 5 minutes and then we'll swap you back type thing. Again, you create habits that help your team and help the individuals within your team.
Yeah, that's why I often think about this idea of effort. Like there's certain people are better at trying hard than others. There's a natural aspect of it. But is there anything more important in an environment that you create that actually coaches effort, you know, that we actually, because people don't, there's all limitations that we put on ourselves. Like you're on a bike, you climb a hill, you go, gee, I'm not going to get up this, so you get the top, and the next hill's not as bad. All those sort of elements of it. And I'm convinced, I didn't think you could. Yeah. I thought, you know, I used to hear people, you know, be after games, oh, they didn't bring their best game. We didn't see, it wasn't their A game today. And that can happen when people lose confidence, that type of thing. But I'm thinking, really almost it's the ultimate measure of an environment when we've got people trying their hardest.
Correct.
Just as the most basic measure is, are our people trying as hard as they possibly can, you know?
And so I would struggle as a leader if I had to coach effort into someone.
Yeah.
Because I feel that it's a non-negotiable. Like it's part of your role is to come and do, in your role, you don't ride effort, but you can't do any of those things in your role unless you're trying hard and working hard.
And that's assuming they know what effort is.
Yeah, true.
So that would be the only caveat I'd put on. I agree on that. So if we're dealing with a whole lot of, if we're playing State of Origin, well, you're not having a coach effort.
No.
But if you're under 11s, the kid doesn't know what trying looks like, really. The first time you get puffed, you know. And it was an interesting thing because I was an asthmatic and also I am, but I used to think everyone got puffed after 100 metres and I'd have to stop or whatever it was. And then I got a ventil and it's not like that. And I realised that I just thought I was bad at something. And some kids think that they're just not very good at it until you actually coach them through the various barriers that they're going to. And I find that even in organisations, yes, you can go there. You can get comfortable with that level of discomfort. And you will learn a lot about yourself if you're prepared to actually take that on. You don't have to try and, you know, don't go from you haven't been for a run for 10 years, try and run a marathon first up. But let's just show that you can actually
learn the steps.
And I think, you know, and like my sense here, people try hard.
Yep.
You know, I've got the one thing you don't have to question is that, but there's probably another level that they'll find that they can go over time as the expectations rise. And
Yeah, it's fair.
Yeah. Little thought, I always like to finish with a little question for me. Anything come to mind when you comes off the top? Because we've actually started to do some conversations together, which has been really interesting. Yeah.
I think probably big one is when you're coaching the same team over and over again, you actually get to know the intricacies and it's a lot easier. When you're coaching, so now you're coaching someone who goes to coach their team, but you don't all probably 5% of the time you actually get to see them coaching their team.
Yeah.
So a lot of the feedback is probably only coming from the person you're coaching.
Yeah.
Not from the people that they're coaching. And because you're not in that environment. And as sort of a conversation I had with someone yesterday around, it was Shane McCurry, we were talking about as a consultant, which I've done too, where you go in and...
And he's done all the leadership work at Richmond.
Yep.
Is he still doing work with
Richmond, Adam? Richmond, he's doing the Vixens. Yeah. He's been hugely successful and
He's a great.
Love chatting to him. Yeah, and we talked about when you're going in as a consultant, you sort of might be a one day a week, whatever it is. How hard it is to be able to be across everything and make sure you are. So the things you put in place or the people you do get feedback from, to make sure you're not just hearing it from one.
Yeah. So the answer is you're coaching in an incomplete way.
Yep.
But I would always think that you're never going to be coaching in a complete way would be part of it. So all I seek to – I always ask three questions. So if it's not going the way that the person would hope it is, so the first question is, have you coached it well enough? That's question one. And we talk to that simply because that's just not a reflection on the person themselves, but – on the environment that they're creating. So is the environment, say what we talked about before, have you created an environment as the CEO of Eclair, as the coach of Carlton, as the CEO of a major business, have you created the environment where people try hard, work hard? And if you just put it in that context, because the first thought is if you're that, no, it's not personal here. It's just, and they go, no, I think there's some things we can do better. Okay, cool. Let's talk to those. The second one is, have you supported the learning environment the way that you should have. Like, for instance, we'll often give people leadership roles but ask them to continue to do their previous role. And so all we're doing is weighed them up. Yep. And so they're now making trade-offs every day of their life. And often people when they're coming into those roles aren't very good at making those trade-offs because they've got this expectation you've put on them, but you're still asking them to make numbers, do other things. So all they do is actually work a lot longer and a lot harder and just exhaust themselves and do neither job well.
Yep.
So have we supported the learning? But sometimes it can be just a physical thing. It can be you've given them a good screen. You've given them, it can be just simply that. And the third one is there anything going on for them? You know, they've got, you know, their kids are really struggling at school or, you know, they've got, you know, a situation where, you know, they're having to travel a lot and it's really affecting their relationships at home or their health's started to wane.
Yep.
And so if you go through the one, two and three, and the fourth one always, because we often go to then a place of judgment that the person's not good enough, so or the group's not good enough or the team's not good enough. But if you don't go through one, two, three and four, you get one, two and three and get to four and just say, we've got the wrong people here.
Yep.
Well, hang on, I'm not sure, you know, because the people is always going to be a it's never going to be perfect. It's never, you know, like – you know, you win the premierships. Were you the best team? Arguably you were, but there's probably any one of four or five teams could have won it in that year.
Yep.
You just got the dynamic right at the right time to win it the way that you did through probably a combination of all those three things. But recognizing that all you're actually doing is creating the space for the person to go into themselves, because I always say I'm not an advice giver. If I was actually viewing it and seeing it, and I would be much more specific. But I'm actually asking them to actually
view it and see it,
find it. Are they looking for the right things?
Because the hardest part about that is though it takes so much time and effort to be able to go and break up your day to go and observe those things.
Yeah,
because everyone's got a different perspective. Because if I observe it and you observe it, we come away with two different things. And that was
the most important ones are their observations. And the danger is that they're not making those observations.
Yep.
So if because they're so overwhelmed, there's always another meeting, another player to see, another person to see, another, you know, there is that. And And it's really easy to get caught up in that. So if there's one practice which we coach to more than anything, it's a practice of reflection.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd say there's two elements of it, that every high-performance environment in the world has a coach.
Yep.
Everyone.
Yep.
I'm sure number one tennis players, when was the last one who didn't have a coach?
Yep.
You know, they've all got them. And I would say that they probably know often more than what their coach
yep.
does. But the idea around it is a second set of eyes to look at the same problem will give you a different
yeah,
view.
Yeah. Yep.
Because you only ever bring one imagination into your own life.
Yep.
And so the conversations we get to have is we draw on each other's imaginations
yep.
and our which come from an experience that we've had.
Yeah.
But it was intuitively not available to me when I first started coaching, to be honest, because I thought CEOs were so...
Supposed to have all the answers.
Supposed to have the answers.
Yep.
Yeah. And so I used to think that, you know, I had to ride in on my white horse as the person with all the answers, and I was the least informed person in the organisation to have those answers.
Yep.
And so it was but I just felt my idea of leadership was that's what leaders do.
Yeah.
They're smart people, have answers.
And I think that's the conversation around, so what does leadership look like to you?
Yeah.
And then what would my observation of your leadership look like?
Yeah. And you would have gone to that a lot, wouldn't you? Even with guys like Craig Bellamy, unbelievably accomplished coaches.
Yep.
That my assumption was, it'd want to be pretty compelling what you're offering.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But he'd be open.
Yeah. And that was also 100% he was. When I started with the Storm doing the emerging leaders, the sort of 24, 25-year-olds, and so leadership to them was Cameron Smith, Billy Slater, Cooper Cronk.
Mm.
Now, in rugby league, they're the finished product.
Yeah, and royalty, just beyond. Yep.
They're the Queensland captains, the Australian captains.
Mm.
So for those boys, it was like, that's unreachable. I'm never going to be that.
Mm.
So we actually had to break it down and show, well, what's leadership for you guys look like? And the very first conversation was, who's showing leadership today? And there was one guy no one put their hand up, and I said, well, you have. And I said, you were getting coffee at Cheeky Monkeys this morning on Swan Street.
Yeah.
And he sort of looked at me and said, I was caught behind a tram and there was an old lady walking on a frame, and she walked to the door to go through and she couldn't hold the frame and open the door, and you leapt out of your seat, ran across, opened the door. She went through, closed the door, went back and sat down.
Mm.
I said, that's leadership, because there's 20 people who saw you do that. Now, next time that happens, they're embarrassed that they didn't do it. So the next time it happens, they're going to jump out of the seat, run across, open that door for the lady.
Mm.
And then there'll be 20 people that saw them do it. Then they're going to be embarrassed and go, oh, I should have done that. And they're the ones that are going to be the first to act next time. So don't think of it as the finished product, Cameron Smith giving you a pump-up speech. Think of it as my next step. And fortunately enough, six of the eight of them ended up captains of NRL clubs because we broke it down and showed also what they're good at and what they're not good at.
Yeah.
So you don't have to – Jesse Bromwich led by example. Mm. He was just the beast. He was the big guy, and he was – everyone – when Jesse was out in the field, they all stood taller because they just knew what he was going to bring every time.
Mm.
And then it was about coaching through, well, what are the little things you want to say in front of the group instead of just allowing others to say it. And then he'd work through that, and he ended up Captain Storm, and he ended up Captain the Dolphins as well. And it's been hugely successful, but it's around, you don't have to be Cameron Smith.
No.
So
they're comparing themselves with a very finished product, aren't
correct.
They?
Yeah. And even if it wasn't, so I didn't compare myself to Nathan Buckley or to Scott Burns, who were the captains I played under. So I was just who I was. So it's actually coming back to, who do you want to be? What do I think you're good at, and what are the things I think we can put some support around you for? So when Cameron Smith's off having to kick the goal once you've scored a try, or is there someone else who can say something in there if you don't want to be the one that says it?
Yeah.
So it's just
it's a great way of thinking, because I think in life there's a real challenge that we, there's a wonderful saying, comparison's a thief of joy.
Yep.
That if you're not careful, you're comparing your 22-year-old version of you with a 31-year-old version of a star who would probably looked a fair bit like you when he was 22, you know. So there is that, and I think in terms of succession, that's really challenging, you know, because the person doesn't necessarily see themselves as that at that point. And it's a really great take. And I do think that, particularly where, if the leader was a star, like if it was Nathan Buckley, for instance, who was a recognised star, or, you know, like even, you know, moving on from Scott Pendlebury at, yep. at Collingwood, who's just, you know, might be the best ever Collingwood yep. player now, is probably in that, definitely in that conversation. Yeah. No, it's wonderful, mate. I really enjoyed the opportunity of getting to know you. It's funny because you can actually be in the same world as people and not get to know them. Yep. And but just doing the work to do today, and I reckon we can take this a whole lot further and really enjoy the chat today. But it's been great getting to know you, and it's great having the conversation today. Thanks for being in the arena with us.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers.